The really cool thing from a kind of operational standpoint of managing these types of assets are you don't have to worry about tenants. You don't have to worry about property maintenance. You're not the one that's responsible for paying the taxes and the insurance. So you're buying a note and you're the lender, and the borrower is the one that is responsible for those things. And they're the one that's paying the monthly payments, and you get the benefit of that.
Welcome to Passive Income Unlocked, where we unlock the doors to intelligent, hands-off real estate investing. We talk to experts in the space about what they do, how they do it, and most importantly, why they do it. My passion is careful, intelligent investing and closing the investing gap one investor at a time. While money doesn't buy happiness, passive income does have the potential to buy back your time. What would you choose to do with your time if you had enough passive income to live your best life? How would you like to spend your days? What kind of impact would you like to make? I'm here to tell you, dream big. There's no ceiling. It's all possible if you take consistent action towards your goals. It's been said that success is 80% mindset and 20% strategy. So we discuss both. Ready to gain knowledge and take action? Let's dive in.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to the show. Today I'm so excited to announce our guest and my good friend Ben Frazier to the show. Ben, thanks so much for being here.
Yes, thanks for having me on. I'm excited.
Awesome. So everyone, Ben is Vice President of Finance at Aspen Funds, an Inc. 5000 company, and has helped raise over $50 million in private investment capital from individual and institutional investors for their real estate note funds. Prior to Aspen, Ben was a commercial lender and a commercial credit underwriter, personally responsible for underwriting over $125 million in commercial real estate and business loans. Ben is a contributor on the Forbes Finance Council. He is also co-host of the Invest Like a Billionaire podcast. Awesome. Well, super excited to have you on the show, Ben. Why don't you start with taking us back in time and telling us where you were before real estate and what drew you into the space?
Yeah, I kind of fell into it, you know, happy accident. So got a finance degree, MBA, and knew I wanted to be in finance, but, you know, it's a very broad world. And so I started kind of a very meandering route at a kind of boutique asset management firm. So working with publicly traded funds, really institutional investors, and they kind of had a niche asset class that I helped them grow that business in, and then moved into banking, commercial banking. So I was a commercial loan underwriter for a while, and then a commercial lender. And so that's when I kind of got exposed to real estate. You know, from your background, you know as well, when you see a lot of these, when you're doing these loans for these wealthy individuals, especially, I would always be curious, what are they invested in? What was their net worth made up of? And predominantly it was real estate. And it just always stuck with me that a lot of these most successful clients of the banks that I worked for were generally, you know, pretty heavy into real estate, whether as a passive investor or as an active developer or investor. And so it kind of always stuck with me. And I knew I didn't want to stay in banking long-term. It just wasn't appealing to kind of my personality and just where I wanted to go. And so this opportunity with Aspen Funds opened up about 4 years ago now, and made the jump into kind of the private equity real estate world. And kind of the rest is history. We've, you know, had a lot of fun. So when I joined, it was just a few employees, and really one step beyond our beta test fund, and really helped kind of grow the business through marketing and working with individual investors. We really wanted to go after providing these types of opportunities to kind of the average, you know, accredited investor. And yeah, so we have 5 different note funds. These are real estate notes. So it might be kind of a new area of kind of real estate investing to some of your audience. And so happy to dive into that a little bit. And but yeah, we have two strategies that we operate, and we work with a lot of passive investors.
Awesome. I think that's pretty interesting. You know, a lot of us coming across different people, how did they make their wealth? And
yeah,
real estate is such a powerful mechanism for building wealth. And so it makes sense that you were seeing that and then attracted to that path.
Yeah. I was reading a quote the other day, I think it was Andrew Carnegie, that said 90% of all millionaires have been created through real estate, right? And you know, who knows what that number really means or if that's even accurate, but I think it, you know, underscores the point that it's a very powerful tool. And especially passive investing, like what you're focusing here, it's a lot of people think, oh, if I want to get into real estate, I have to go buy single family rentals, right? Or Airbnb, and that's what I'm going to do. But it's the lowest barrier to entry. So it means it's the most competition, and it's also not, it's not passive, right? It's, you're going to be actively managing these. And so, you know, there's this whole world of kind of the funds that we operate and a lot of others like us in different asset classes that provide truly passive opportunities for investors.
For sure. It's such a blessing to be able to invest passively, even if you're an active investor.
Right. Yep.
It's so nice to also put your money into deals, you know, like that, you know, you don't actually have to do any of the execution for. So,
right.
Well, thanks so much for sharing a bit of your background. I would love to talk about notes because we haven't had someone talk about notes yet. It's a really interesting space with a ton of opportunity. And why don't you give us a little bit of the 101 as to what are real estate notes? You know, what does it mean to be a notes investor?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. So notes, you know, very simply, it's basically buying the mortgage. So a mortgage note, and it's just a different way to invest in the real estate. Instead of buying the asset or the property, you're actually buying the debt. And, you know, intuitively, most people understand that when you're the bank, you have a lot of things in your favor, right? When you sign a loan document and you've signed a 1,000-page, you know, promissory note, those are generally protective to the bank. And so when you become a note investor, you're buying the mortgage, and all of those benefits transfer to you as the lender. And the really cool thing from a kind of operational standpoint of managing these types of assets are you don't have to worry about tenants. You don't have to worry about property maintenance. You're not the one that's responsible for paying the taxes and the insurance. So you're buying a note and you're the lender, and the borrower is the one that is responsible for those things. And they're the one that's paying the monthly payments, and you get the benefit of that. And so it's much more passive than kind of a standard, you know, rental property strategy would be. And so there's a lot of individual investors that go and they buy these with their IRA money or their or cash and do it themselves. And then where we kind of fit into the whole, you know, universe of notes is we have passive funds. And so investors, like you said, even whether they're active or they are truly passive, they will also invest in our funds to, you know, outsource some of that work. So it's a pretty cool vehicle if you want to do it actively. And then from our standpoint, at a fund level, it's got a lot of cool dynamics. So we have two different strategies. One is focused on growth. One is focused on income. So our growth strategy is we're buying non-performing notes. So basically, this is a mortgage that a borrower has stopped paying on for whatever reason. And we go buy that note for a very deep discount.
And then Ben, would that be a first position or second position?
So you can buy either. So our firm, we specialize in second mortgages. We also buy first, but we have kind of a real niche that we identify in the seconds. So we'll buy, you know, non-performing junior liens or second position liens behind a performing first lien. I'll go into all that just for time's sake, but it's a pretty cool strategy. A lot of attractive factors around that. But the other strategy that we focus on is really kind of our flagship fund is our income fund. And that's where we're buying performing mortgages. So these are both first and second mortgages, and they're performing. So they're making payments every month, but they're kind of what we affectionately call them scratch and dent notes, right? So a lot of times these are bank originated mortgages, but they had some kind of payment hiccup along the way. And it's mostly usually temporary. So it's the borrower had a job loss, a medical crisis, or a divorce, something that was very disruptive to their financial situations, but they wanted to stay in the house. So they figured out, you know, a new payment of terms with the lender and started paying again. So they're paying, but as you know, from your banking background, it's generally going to be risk rated higher. So the bank has to reserve additional capital against it. They have to risk rate it higher. The regulators kind of push on those if they have too much of them. And then ultimately banks, they're not in the business of taking back collateral, and they don't want to deal with headaches. So they'll sell those for discounts, and usually substantial discounts. So anywhere from a 20 to a 50% discount to par value or what the borrower owes. And so for us, it creates a really nice yield, right? Because we're getting it for a discount. And it also is generally pretty capital protective, especially if you have a deep equity position, kind of what we are more focused on. So it's a pretty cool vehicle. And generally it's, you know, most of these borrowers just keep paying until they refinance or get paid off. But if they stop paying for whatever reason, we have the ability to take back the properties, right? And so when we're underwriting these, we're underwriting more to the property than we are to the borrower, which is more like a hard money lender, if you know, you're familiar with that. And, you know, it's another source of repayment. So in the 8 years of doing this fund, or 7.5 years, we've had a few defaults in the fund, but we've actually made profit on average on all those defaults. I think we've made 25% profit, even when a borrower stops paying us, and really because of these discounts. So it's pretty cool.
Awesome. Thanks so much for that overview. Really helpful. One thing I hear people saying about the note space, and some for the listeners who aren't familiar, oftentimes people say, well, we're helping people stay in their homes when you're doing, you know, notes investing. Can you explain how a little bit of the mechanics of how you actually can help people stay in their homes?
This show is sponsored by Lux Capital Investment Group. Lux Capital provides pre-vetted, highly favorable investment opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis. Our opportunities are diversified across asset classes, geographies, and operators. We are nothing short of rigorous in our approach to evaluating investments. We focus on downside protection, conservative underwriting, recession-resistant asset classes, and forging strong relationships with operating partners and investors. If you want to be an intelligent, hands-off investor and gain access to the types of deals that I like to invest in personally, make sure to go to lux-cap.com, L-U-X-E-cap.com, and sign up for our newsletter.
Totally. So, you know, shifting gears back to the growth strategy, because the income fund, they're already paying, they're in their homes, we're happy, we're getting a good yield. We want them to keep paying. So, you know, we're not going to do anything that would disrupt that. But on the non-performing note side, that is where we have to work out a deal with the borrowers, right? And so the whole goal there is to have a conversation with the borrower, say, you know, where are you at financially? What can you afford? And so we have 5 different exit strategies that we can employ in that when they're not paying. The last of which is foreclosure, right? Which is kind of, no one wants to go through that. We don't want to go through that. It's a headache. Historically, we've exited over, I think, 1,000 notes at this point, and we've only gone to foreclosure 2% of the time. So it's very, very rare. And so what we're able to do is work out usually a loan modification or a settlement agreement with the borrower. So I'll give you some quick numbers to kind of put just color around it. So say we have a $100,000 mortgage, we'll generally be able to buy that. And this is a second mortgage, right? So it's a deeper discount than a first, but we'll be able to buy that for around $30,000. And we'll have a conversation with the borrower. We'll get a package of their financials and figure out what they can afford. We'll put together a new payment. We'll re-amortize the loan. And then we'll get them to start paying on it again. We'll get a good faith payment up front. And after they've made a few payments, it's considered performing. We can sell that back to the secondary market as a performing loan. And because it's performing, we've now created value. And usually we're hitting about a 2 to 2.5x gross revenue multiple, meaning on that $30,000, we're going to be usually generating, you know, we can sell that for around $75,000. And you know, they still owe $100,000. So there's, you know, for the investor that wants to buy the cash flow, there's still protection there. We kind of create the value to get to that point and know how to structure these where they keep paying. So the cool thing is, in that scenario, we're making a really good return. The borrower is in an affordable payment that they can stay in the house and keep paying. The other main strategy we do is a settlement. So we'll go and, so same numbers, $100,000 mortgage, we buy it for $30,000. We say, hey, how about you pay us off at $60,000 or $65,000? And a lot of times they have money in a 401k, they have other cash sitting around, they have, you know, a loan from a family member, and they'll pay us off. And so we'll wipe out $30,000 to $40,000 of debt. So they're super happy. And we're really happy because we made a decent return as well. So those are kind of the mechanics around it. And for the most part, you know, 98% of the time, people get to stay in their home. So it's kind of a win-win-win. So we love that. There are players out there, I'll say, that want to use this as a leverage point to go and take a property at a discount and kick people out. And that's not what we're interested in. You know, one, just from the ethical, moral side of it, you know, we don't feel good about that. And then two, it's not scalable. So it's, you know, taking back properties. We have assets in 45 states. We have over, you know, nearly 2,000 assets in 40 states. So it's more complicated, right? It's just a lot of extra headache.
For sure. And then why would the banks sell those notes to you at such a discount?
Yeah. So I kind of hit on it a little bit, but really they have to risk rate these higher. So what that means is they have to reserve additional capital that it's really an opportunity cost for them, because the way the banks are structured is they have capital that they raise, equity capital that they lend against. and they need to be able to lend as much as they can against that capital to generate, hit their margins that they need. So if they have to reserve additional capital as a reserve for this loan, then they can't lend out as much of their capital. So it's an opportunity cost, number one. Number two, the regulators don't like them to have too much in these higher risk ratings. And so they will kind of force them to liquidate or dispose of some assets, even if they're performing, right? It's called a troubled debt restructure. It's a TDR. And kind of the saying in banking is once a TDR, always a TDR. So even if they've been paying for 5 years and they had missed a few payments 5 years ago, it's still a TDR and they're never going to recover. So the banks are incentivized to get rid of these. And then two, you know, a lot of times these are borrowers that, you know, if they've stopped paying once, the likelihood of that happening again are higher. And so they don't want to have to take back the property. And for them, it's only a loss if it doesn't work out, right? Because they're holding on their books at $100,000. But we can go buy that for, say, $60,000. And even if the borrower stops paying, we still have enough margin to go make that and usually more. Like I said, in the default cases, we're making a 25% return on average. And that's because we have a lot of margin. So they're willing to sell them at a discount because that's kind of what the market rate is for them.
Okay, cool. Thanks. Well, thanks so much for all that talk on notes. I'm sure we could talk at length about many more notes aspects. But for now, let's transition to talking about the difference between investing in funds and syndications, because I know you have experience with both.
Yeah, exactly. So the way we're structured are as funds. And so it's a little bit different. You know, a lot of investors, they get exposed to these types of investments, are maybe more familiar with syndications. And a syndication is generally going to be like in a multifamily property, for example, the operator is going to go raise equity for a single property, and they'll close on that property, and then they execute their business plan and then have the whole return dynamics along the way. But one of the inherent limitations is it's a single property, right, in a single market, and you know what the property is up front. You have a little more risk from a diversification standpoint. So a fund is, you know, in our case, we have in our income fund, we have over 1,000 mortgages in 40 states. So we have a lot of diversification across a number of assets, a number of geographies. And because that fund is an open-end fund, meaning that we're always taking on new capital and we're growing the fund, it doesn't have a, you know, definite period of time, you actually know what's in the fund. So you can see and underwrite, you know, what's actually the portfolio that is today. But a lot of other funds, the other strategy we do, which are our closed-end funds, which are growth funds, those are blind pool funds. So it's higher returns usually, but it's a blind pool, meaning you don't know what assets we're going to buy ahead of time, but we have a strategy. We've, you know, done it 5 times. So we can have some level of confidence. We can execute on it. But again, you get diversification. So it's kind of a little bit of, you know, trade-offs there where you may not have as much visibility into the actual assets that you're buying into, but you generally get good diversification. Generally, they're going to be bigger in scale, right? So you get some just size economies of scale there. And so those are kind of the real key differences, I'd say.
For sure. Awesome. Well, thanks for that overview. I definitely really like how you explained all of that. And now, before we start to wrap up, would you give us some of your special or your favorite tips for people who are just new to this industry and getting ready to invest in a syndication or a fund?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I told you we're launching a podcast here soon called Invest Like a Billionaire. And we recently surveyed our audience to say, hey, what are the biggest challenges you experience when you're trying to invest in these types of investment opportunities, right? And one of the biggest challenges was, well, I don't know how to do due diligence. I don't know what questions to ask. I don't have confidence enough to know to find the good opportunities from the bad opportunities. And, you know, in working with a lot of different passive investors, there seems to be this kind of disconnect, you know, and most investors are not professional investors, right? And so there's just some inherent limitations. But what I've been finding too is a lot of times investors can overcomplicate it. And I think there's a whole lot of just kind of the inherent gut feel that, you know, I don't want to overemphasize the importance of that. But generally, if you're getting a decent, good feeling of just all the factors that are kind of coming into play and you have a good experience talking with them, the track record makes sense, generally, that's actually a pretty good indication, right? And, you know, I think start there, find the people that when you're aligned with value-wise, strategy-wise, and then the next thing I would say is ultimately track record, right? It kind of all comes down to that for me. And you know, when I'm investing my own money, I don't want to work with unknown quantities. I want to look at what have you done before and am I being compensated for that risk that, you know, whether it's a newer sponsor or an established sponsor, and, you know, the risk parameters are much more mitigated. So that's a pretty big factor. Some of the kind of more finer things that I would look at when you're looking at an operating agreement is kind of incentive structure. And this one would be a little more nuanced of just learning the ways that sponsors are more motivated. So part of it is, do they have skin in the game? Are they investing as a passive investor as well? But then how do they make most of their money, right? Are they charging a lot of fees, right, on the front end? Or are they getting paid after a preferred return with their investors? And what do those splits look like after? And are they taking an asset management fee? When are they taking that? And so looking at really, you know, it all kind of comes down to the money, right? How are they making money? When did they make money? And is it prioritize the passive investor first? And, you know, most of the sponsors that, you know, I'm familiar with and recommend to folks are ones that do that. And it's pretty obvious that they're doing that. And then the last thing, you know, I would say, and I'm reluctant to say this because I don't always like it when people ask me as a sponsor to do this, but investor references, right? And what better way to learn about the sponsor than talking with their current investors. And so we're getting pretty big to where sometimes I'll make introductions for investors, but what we've actually done is we've recorded a lot of testimonials of our investors as videos. As we're bringing out, you know, talking with, you know, hundreds of potential investors every quarter. So it's a little hard to scale that, but especially smaller investors, look for testimonials, see if they're willing to make some introductions to investors that they're currently working with. And then talk with them, hear about their experiences. You know, the other thing that's really important, at Aspen, we try to really do is be extra communicative. So we're putting together really in-depth quarterly reports talking about the fund performance. We send out financials every quarter, exactly what's going on in the fund. And we send out investor statements. So ask for those, you know, ask for the investor communications, because you're generally, you know, going to be locked into these deals for a while, unless it has liquidity like one of our funds does. But it's generally going to be a long-term relationship. So you want to make sure you're going to be happy and pleased with the level of communication that they're providing. So those are some of the kind of quick tips I would say just off the bat.
For sure. Yeah, I really like all of those. That makes a lot of sense. And, you know, it's so important that alignment of interest, that the sponsor's interests are aligned with the investors, just speaking to one of the points that you mentioned.
Yeah.
Yeah, I also really like that tip about asking for previous updates and communication, so you know what the updates are going to look like. I mean, that's not something I've done yet, but it sounds like a really good idea.
Yeah. Usually you can get a pretty good sense reading through like past reports of how transparent are they, you know, what kind of things did they share? Like we try to, you know, in ours be very transparent, share the good and the bad and the potential challenges. Like with COVID, you know, we did in my opinion, an above and beyond job of trying to just get in front of it. Here's the potential challenges. We don't exactly know how this is going to affect our business, but we're on top of it. And it just gave our investors confidence, right? Because they knew we're looking at it, we're protecting their capital. And you know, thankfully it didn't impact our business much at all, but you can get a really good sense of, you know, their values, how they operate, and are they doing what they say they're going to do through the simple communication. So it's definitely a good hack.
Yeah, for sure. Awesome. Well, so much valuable information in this interview, Ben. Thanks so much for coming on. Would you please take a moment to share with the listeners how they can get a hold of you and anything else you'd like to share?
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously check out our website, aspenfunds.us. You can just Google Aspen Funds and you can kind of see our open offerings there, learn about our strategies, our team. And then we're also doing a podcast called investlikeabillionaire.com. And really the goal there is to help educate around alternative investments. So, you know, most of that's going to be real estate. We're also talking private equity and hedge funds. And we're doing a lot of kind of passive investor spotlights, learning from other passive investors of how they allocate, what types of asset classes, what their successes, their failures, as well as learning all different types of kind of opportunities in the world of alternative investments.
Awesome. Well, I'm definitely excited to check that out. Thanks so much again, Ben, for coming on, and we'll see you next time.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for listening to Passive Income Unlocked. Before you go on to continue with your amazing day, please take a moment to reflect on what you truly desire in life. Then think about one thing you can do to push the ball forward in that direction. Also, please head over to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave an honest rating and review of this show. It really would mean so much to me. Passive Income Unlocked is brought to you by Lux Capital. Lux works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate. We are closing the investing gap one investor at a time. Connect online at www.lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, for tons of free educational content to further your success.